Is your appetite sometimes out of control? Are you unable to stop eating even when you're full? Download our new Intelligent Medicine video, Defensive Eating, Taming Your Addiction to Food. There's a physiological basis for food addiction. The food industry has gripped our brains using powerful food science. Find out what we can do about it. Go to drhoffman.com to download this important video. We will arm you with proven strategies to change your eating behavior forever. Go to drhoffman.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to cover a subject which is extremely timely because statistics have just revealed that fully one half of the American populace is either diabetic or pre-diabetic. This is a very dire state of affairs, and we're going to talk to an expert to address this problem. Jim LaValle is a nationally recognized clinical pharmacologist. He is author of Cracking the Metabolic Code, and he has weighed in with us before. He's an author, he's a board-certified clinical nutritionist, and he has a wealth of experience dealing with nutritional issues. And his book is excellent, Cracking the Metabolic Code. We've talked about that in a previous podcast. So take it away, Jim. It's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine.
Oh, it's fantastic to be here. It is alarming when you think that 10% of our population is diabetic. Another 40% are pre-diabetic, and the statistics show that in our near future, 40 to 50% of the U.S. population will be diabetic. And as you well know, Dr. Hoffman, I mean, the big problem is that once people get diabetes, my whole family is riddled with diabetes. So my father, his brothers, my uncles, my aunts, everybody is plagued by this problem in our family. So the first thing you think is, uh-oh, that means it's genetic. And really what's going on is that it's this complex interplay of lifestyle issues and exposures and stress of modern living and the visual cues we get to simply eat that is creating quite of a march for all of us towards this insulin resistance and diabetes syndrome.
Well, of course, there's a difference between genetics and what's called epigenetics. Maybe you can frame the discussion a little bit, because, yeah, there's a genetic contribution, because some people, they could eat like a house on fire. Those lucky few may not become obese or develop diabetes. They're extremely resistant. But then there's this word epigenetics that has really entered our lexicon. So what's up with that?
Well, of course. So, you know, what really influences us from the time we're in our mother's womb to today, like when I discuss, I just came back from teaching a course on autoimmunity to docs. And, you know, what it really is about is that from the time we're in our mother's womb to who we are today, the influences of diet, lifestyle, previous conditions, drug history, previous diet, stress burden, you know, all of these forces are acting on our chemistry, which you can, you know, turn on certain genes, turn off certain genes. But in the end, when you talk to folks, you know, Mondo Biotech, for example, you know, one of the leading guys there, Fabio Cavalli, real worldwide leader in genetic diseases, he even admits, it's like, you know what, 95% of this is dictated by what we're getting exposed to and what we do to ourselves. And so, you know, those lucky few that can eat whatever they want, see, it used to be that about 70% of our population we thought was that way, and now we see that 75% of our population, in fact, can eat whatever they want and they gain weight. And see, I happen to think that it's just a matter of time when the exposures, the stress, the poor food quality, the lack of sleep, the alterations in exercise, you know, on all these things virtually affect all of us, because, you know, we're the genetic few. They're just that. They're the unicorns out there, right? They're the people that, you know, when you and I got into this work of integrative care, you know, you'd always hear the person say to you, my grandfather used to drink, you know, whiskey every day and smoke, and he lived to be 98. And you know what? He's the lucky one. He won the lottery. Because for most of us, we get inundated, right? We're inundated with visions of cupcakes, pizza. You don't see any broccoli wars on the Food Channel. There's no, right? I mean, we're not, so, and when you think about it, it's not much different than Pavlov's dogs. I mean, I still remember the classic Pavlov's dogs, right? They give the dog food. It's salivating. When the red light goes on in the room where they're going to feed it, then eventually they just turn the red light on and the dog salivates, knowing it's going to get fed. We're not that much different. You get Instagrams of what's the latest food you got, Pinterest, Facebook. I'm on the West Coast at 7 p.m. eating dinner. I send a picture to my friend on the East Coast at 10 p.m. He should be going to bed. Instead, he's foraging around in his stinking fridge looking for something to eat because I sent him a visual cue. And I really believe that that's playing a much more powerful role than we may want to believe. But look at the explosion of the food network. I came from the food industry. My father was one of the most decorated chefs in the world. So I'm not anti-food. I'm just telling you that I don't see any bakeries going out of business. And I don't see any broccoli stands popping up anywhere.
Well, so this would be the so-called obesogenic environment. There's a temptation everywhere. We're stimulated with it. Well, it's paradoxical because on the one hand, we're told we need to diet, diet, diet. There's all these, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. On the other hand, we're being tempted. So it's really like we're being pulled in two different directions.
You become schizophrenic, and you see that in practice, right? So when people come in, they want to lose weight. They think I got some magic pill that's going to shut off their cravings, desires, and passions for food. And what it is that it's getting across that understanding that, people have different reasons. We put together a big weight loss program for a major fitness chain, a million-member fitness chain. And when I walked in and talked to them, it was funny because they said, we need you to help us with weight loss. And this is one of the biggest fitness chains going on. I said, well, why do you need me to help you with weight loss? You got these, huge facilities, all these pieces of equipment, all these instructors. We got one problem. And I said, what's that? Nobody's losing weight.
That's ultimately, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a real practical problem to be in business with. And the point was we went in there and started to educate people that if you're looking at the problem of diabetes and weight gain, look at the Journal of Sports Medicine, just came out a couple months ago. The problem with obesity and diabetes in this country isn't that we don't exercise enough. It's that we eat too many carbs and sugars.
Right, and that's actually part of the strategy of the food industry to say, hey, anything goes in moderation. We're just too sedentary. And they even sponsor exercise programs where they give out, little prizes, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, because they believe that, part of a healthy lifestyle. And our problem is we're just sitting on our butts too much. But actually, they are the culprits, right?
I really feel that they are. I try to get people to understand. I hope that I'm allowed to eat a cupcake once in a while. This really isn't about, oh my gosh, you can never eat a piece of cake again. You can never have a cupcake again. But let's face it, people are doing it on a daily basis. They're getting overnourished by far with soda pops like Cokes, like Pepsis. I mean, we're drinking, 11 teaspoons of sugar per 12 ounces, 9 to 11 anyway, if we want to be accurate. And the reality is that's one segment of the issue, that we're over-nurtured and over-nourished. I'm back to teaching people how to count carbs. Dr. Hoffman, I thought I would never have my staff go back to teaching people how they need to count carbohydrates. But we know what happened was people said, well, hey, I'm seeing all these new green living ads and being healthy. So now I'm ordering organic brown rice. I'm buying it at the store. I'm cooking it. And I'm still eating 8 servings.
Right.
Right?
Let me share with you, this is a little vignette, okay? It just happens to be in a publication we both read. It's the Townsend Letter for Doctors and Patients.
Sure.
And it's by a guy who may be familiar to you. He's certainly familiar to me because he's been a guest on this program. He's a cancer expert. His name is Ralph Moss. And Ralph shares his own personal experience around diabetes. He said, around 1 year ago, I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. My blood glucose was 390. My hemoglobin A1C was 12.3. We know it should be, less than 6. My fasting glucose was 164. So what did he do? He turned it around. He lost weight from 203 pounds to 162 pounds. And he didn't do it through conventional medicine. He did it through a natural approach. He says, so how did I accomplish this? The brief answer is that I went on a low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet. He says this approach flies in the face of the idea that carbohydrates are somehow essential nutrients. He eliminated sugar, any other sweeteners, cut out all grains, including for now whole grains. He severely limited his intake of fruits and root vegetables, which are sugary or starchy. You see the before and after picture, and the blood sugar is normalized. No more type 2 diabetes. Is this in line with some of your experience with patients?
Well, I'm big on a modified low-carb diet. I tell you, I've been on kind of I've worked through the ketogenic type diets and the kind of paleo, strict paleo diets. And what we've come to the conclusion of is people need a little bit of resistant starch from somewhere, because the beneficial flora in the gut, when I do digestive stool analysis on people who eat really high diets, the flora of their gut tends to skew. So there might be some short-term benefit, but I worry about the long-term. I think what Ralph
You're starving their microbiome a little bit by putting them on such a restrictive diet.
Exactly. So making sure they get a little bit of resistant starch. But I got to tell you, I've been a fan of lower carbohydrate diets and really restraining people from grains for a long time. I mean, in excess of 25 years, I've been telling people that. And here's the thing. I wrote a chapter in a cancer book, textbook, and it was about the from diabetes to cancer epidemiologic cause and molecular links was the title. That's pretty technical.
Wow.
But the point of the whole thing was, when your blood sugars go up and you're living in that diabetic state, you are putting your cells in a perfect environment to develop cancer. And so, of course, the Nobel Prize was delivered for, Otto Warburg's work in the 1930s for showing that once you have cancer cells, they have a voracious appetite for sugar. And so I think it is what we don't really get. I don't think that gets transcended. You opened up the radio show today by saying 50% of the U.S. population is either has diabetes or is insulin resistant. Guess what? That means that 50% of our population is right in the crosshairs of, from a molecular level, from the cell out, from the epigenetic expression, is of developing cancer of one form or another, most likely bladder, colon, breast, are the biggies, right?
And then, of course, prostate. Prostate, of course.
Prostate's the other one that's linked to it as well.
Sure,
that's correct.
Sure. Yeah.
And so the point being is, this is a big problem. And so I really think that diet's important. And then I think there's other issues. Some people are going to still have starches. I like when people use things, like white kidney bean extract. Really good, really good, ingredient that's got
great data. Can you explain the concept behind resistant starch? Because this is a new buzzword that actually it has utility not just in weight loss, but also we see it in connection to treatment of ulcerative colitis. Is that, you're supposed to be in a low-carb, no-carb specific carbohydrate, but resistant starch actually is developing a little bit of a cachet, right?
It exactly is, and I think that research actually started out first within diabetes. Then we got into the ulcerative colitis, patients. And what happens is that your beneficial flora in your gut need some starch that doesn't get digested, that gets to them and feeds the beneficial flora. Mm-hmm. So these probiotic flora are doing everything from immunomodulation, keeping your tissues from getting inflamed and damaged, to hormone pattern recognition, to sending things like intestinal peptides to tell your brain you're no longer hungry.
Mm.
So the microbiome needs to be fed.
Mm-hmm.
And when we don't take in, if we take in a high-fat diet, or we take in a low-fiber, high-sugar diet, either one of those, if they don't include resistant starch, and resistant starch is starch that you eat, your digestion can't break it down and therefore absorb it across your intestinal lining and end up in your bloodstream as blood sugar. One of the problems is that a lot of our modern grains, even when they're healthy grains like brown rice flour, it's gluten-free, right? Mm-hmm. It still gets milled so fine. that it gets across the milieu really quick. It gets across the intestine fast, still raises your blood sugar.
It's like sugar.
And so it's like sugar. Exactly, you know. And so when you eat resistant starch can come from green bananas. Resistant starch can come from cooling a potato, like a sweet potato or a potato. You cool it.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. There is some kind of chemical reaction. I forget what it's called, but it sort of reestablishes the resistance. If you eat the potatoes hot, it's not so good. You let them cool down, like make a potato salad of sorts.
It's a hydrothermal reaction that relates to the heating of starch.
Mm-hmm.
So when you heat that complex carb, what it does is it causes them to create a chain. You know, they reconnect and chain up, right? So that's how they make even resistant starch powders.
Mm-hmm.
Is they hydroheat, they hydrothermally process, say, cornstarch. And then they give people some of this cornstarch, and lo and behold, their blood sugars get better, their appetite gets better, their inflammatory signals coming from their bowel get better. Now, the other way to do that, and I was got to using things like white kidney bean extract, is when you take white kidney bean extract, you inhibit the absorption of some of your starch.
Mm-hmm.
And so your blood glucose goes down. These are human studies, by the way, not rats. So they don't have a lot of rats coming into me telling me to fix their blood sugar. So this is in humans that it showed a 60% reduction in the glycemic burden of the food. More importantly, because when you take white kidney bean extract, you're making more resistant starch. You're nourishing the microbiome in the large intestine. And then the last piece, of course, is that this is the only thing out there that they've actually, the FDA even allows a claim related to weight loss. And I'm thinking, wow, this is great. They finally are starting to understand weight loss. It's not about a stimulant. It's about managing how our body takes in starch.
So
it processes it.
With the white kidney bean extract, correct me if I'm wrong, aren't there some side effects, you know, like gassiness, flatulence, bloating, or is it relatively benign?
Well, you know, anything you take, like even if you took inulin or like chicory root, any of the prebiotics, everybody's talking about prebiotics.
With fructose oligosaccharides, so-called FOS.
Yeah, any of the prebiotics you take, the first week that you take them, you tend to get gassy because you're feeding these beneficial flora.
And then you adjust.
And they're, you know, processing the carbohydrates. But that usually goes away in most people. Same thing with white kidney bean extract. If people have problems with it at all, it's usually the first week and then they're over it. So I think it's a really interesting concept. Now, obviously, we know there's more to it than that. One of the biggest things I do to help people improve their carbohydrate tolerance is I dose up their magnesium. So I get their magnesium up, and I calculate it. I titrate them to 10 milligrams per kilogram body weight. And because a lot of people, you know, you got, in some estimates, up to 92% of the U.S. population functionally deficient in magnesium. And the number one nutrient deficiency that is associated with the development of MS and diabetes, which is insulin resistance and diabetes, is low magnesium status. And that's government studies. I mean, that's the NIH doing several-year data collections on men and women of various ethnicities. The conclusion is, functional magnesium deficiency leads to type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome. Now, here's the other thing about
why do you think that is? Do you think magnesium is so key to the process of energy production that you get sort of faulty fat-burning, faulty blood sugar utilization if you have low magnesium and sort of an energy brownout in your body?
It's an essential nutrient. It runs 300 enzymes in your body. One of the biggest things it's essential for is the production of ATP. So you don't make energy. When you don't make energy, you don't burn fuel. And so, you know, your glucose regulation goes off. You start to become, so what happens is when you're efficient at burning fuel, your body makes 38 molecules of ATP, right? For every molecule of glucose, you get 38 molecules of energy packets. And I know you know this, but for the sake of your listeners.
Sure.
Now, when you become inefficient at making energy, so your body says, we don't have enough magnesium, we don't have enough chromium, you're under a lot of stress, you got a little bit of pesticide toxicity on that insulin receptor, we can't run the insulin receptor complex to send glucose into your body correctly anymore. That's called the GLUT4 pathway. So it's almost like you can go through toll gate A, which is the way you're supposed to carry the glucose into your body to make 38 molecules of sugar or of energy. So, and then instead it turns on toll gate B that you pull the glucose into the cell, and that only makes two packets of energy. So you make 19 times less energy when your insulin receptors aren't working. Now, what's that translate to the person? It's easy to tell somebody who's diabetic, and you've seen this in your practice, right? They've got a grade 3 ulcer on their leg. They're threatening them to have an amputation. And you know what? They can't stay away from the sweets. Well, I always ask, well, why?
Right.
It's not because they're bad. It's not because they want their foot cut off. It's because when your body is starving, your brain is going to tell you, eat the sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're
like quick energy, right?
Yeah. Your brain needs it, right? That's why Alzheimer's is called type 3 diabetes now.
Mm-hmm.
So the quick energy hit is get the sugar, get the carb. And so when the more inefficient your body is, the more you're going to crave. And I explain this to people when I'm working with them to get their metabolism back on track, to conquer their epigenetics, right? Let's conquer your exposures. Let's conquer your lifestyle. But you have to understand the problem. The problem is it's not that you're weak. It's not that you don't have discipline. The main circuit board in your body, every cell in your body is telling the brain, get some sugar in here now. And until you correct it, at that mitochondrial level, until you get that cellular pathway cleaned up, people fail in their weight loss. And we've seen it, like you said, look at the weight loss industry. $60 billion a year, and our only answer is to do a Roux-en-Y surgery? cut out a part of their stomach, staple it up, and, bypass them a little bit so that they can't eat? There's something, and then what happens? Other behaviors dictate to trigger the brain to do things like drink more, right? So the point being, I think when we look at diabetes, we do disrespect to telling people it's just the food you're eating. It's about the food. It's about the stress. It's about the fact that there's nutrient deficiencies in our calorie-dense, micronutrient-deficient food that we're feeding our people. So they have to eat more in order to get the energy because the micronutrients aren't helping them to perform efficiently anymore.
All right. Well, this is a great point at which to pause because we generally divide these podcasts into two parts. So far, we've covered these aspects of the diabetes epidemic. Of course, to some extent, it's genetic, but also because we have free will and we have the ability to modify our genes, there's something called epigenetics. We can change our fate. Toxicity, you mentioned. Toxicity damaging our insulin receptors, caloric excess, and the obesogenic environment, which continually tempts us. There's magnesium deficiency, which is one among, you're probably in part two going to talk about several other deficiencies, I hope. In part two, let's focus, you mentioned earlier, stress as a factor. We'll talk a little bit about the effects of hormones and non-insulin hormones and other influences on diabetes and, provide people with kind of a roadmap on how to reverse diabetes with natural means. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our guest is Jim LaValle. Jim is a nationally recognized clinical pharmacist, author, board-certified clinical nutritionist, and he's author of a great book, which is Cracking the Metabolic Code. I recommend it very highly. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.